Hey everybody, Tom Lounges here with another edition of Midwest Beat, a program all about music and the people who make it. Tonight we've got a special guest, Al Staley. Al is a former member of the classic rock band Spirit, but he's done so much more. In fact, we're going to hear a little bit of his past tonight. He's got a brand new album called Post-Spirit Volume 1 from the years 1974 to 1978. And we're going to start off with a song that is the current video and also the first single. Wide-Eyed and Innocent, this is Al Staley. He'll be joining us on the other side.
You had a smooth face and a clean slate, but now they're both edged deep with lies. Oh, the wide ambitious, that world looked so delicious, but you went back for seconds too many times. We want it too much too soon. We were wide-eyed and innocent, sweet, sweet babe, in the soft pale light of a sweet summer moon. Oh, we fell in love in the soft pale light of a sweet summer moon. We used to see jaded dreamers who've been stepped on one too many times. Ooh, you could not understand how they could be so weak. Oh, but now your slip is showing and your soul is slipping down into the streets. And your smile's so rustic I can almost hear it squeak.
Or is it new old music? I guess that's the proper way to introduce that one. Wide-Eyed and Innocent. It's off a brand new album called Post-Spirit Volume 1, 1974 to 1978 by Mr. Al Staley. And He was a former member of Spirit. And those of you that know my history know that there were many times I brought Spirit to Northwest Indiana and the South Side here. And Randy California used to call me his man in Indiana. Well, now we have another former member of Spirit joining us. The band is, for the most part, gone. Most of them passed on. But Al Staley is still here. Al, are you with me?
I'm with you, Tom.
Good to hear from you, and I love the new album. I've been listening to it most of today, and a couple of days ago I had the original copy come in on stream, and great sounding, very contemporary, considering these songs are, what, 40 years old or more?
Yeah, probably more than 40. Yeah, they, like I said, 74 to 78 is about this time period.
Yeah.
And really what it all started from was after Spirit, you may or may not know, my brother and I did one album for Epic Records as the Staley Brothers. That, but before it could even have a chance to get any traction, my brother got offered a gig in JoJo Gunn when Matt Andes left. And
right.
They were going strong, and so I couldn't ask him not to do that. So he took that gig, and that's when I decided, well, I'm going to try to get a solo deal. I keep, you know, you join these bands and the bands break up. I'm going to concentrate on writing songs that are suitable for solo record. And so that's what these songs really represent. The stuff that I recorded, there was a point in time where it looked like Epic was going to sign me to a solo deal, and they gave me a budget for John Boylan to produce some of those songs on this record, like Safe Cracker and Too Long Alone and Stand in Love and Coastin', I believe, were all part of that. And then just before the deal happened, Steve Popovich, who was head of A&R, left to start Cleveland International with Meatloaf. And so that deal didn't happen. Then I got a solo deal, started the record, had Steve Cropper on guitar, also Snuffy Walden and on guitar, and Gary Malibur on drums, and Al Garth on sax and violin. And at any rate, got in the middle of the album, the record company went out of business. So, so these recordings have languished for some time, and I thought it was time to get them out there.
Wow, talk about a series of bad luck.
Well, we could go on and on, but any rate, there I'm really I'm finding that not only people of my generation, but I've had a lot of millennials and say that they're now into a lot of the mid-70s music with, you know, there's been a lot of attention given to some of the documentaries like Laurel Canyon and all these things. So, you know, maybe it's good timing for it.
That's true. Now, you're an entertainment lawyer today, is that correct?
That's right. And I've been doing it for quite a while. Like Stevie Ray Vaughan was one of my first significant clients back in the early 80s when did his deal with Columbia and Epic. And yeah, still doing it today and still performing. Actually, I didn't perform while I was raising my son. And once he went off to college, my brother and I still do gigs around Texas and hopefully beyond here.
As the Staley Brothers still?
Yeah, usually we do it as Staley Brothers. And actually, I've done a new album that's in the can that's going to come out next year that's not with my brother, that I've kind of referred to as an accidental album, because during 2020, we have a place out in West Texas close to Big Bend National Park, a little town called Marathon. 45 minutes down the road is Marfa, Texas. And so we were out there for a month during the lockdown, and I got to thinking, you know, I got a bunch of songs I keep saying I'm going to record, and I haven't done it. So I knew two good musicians in Marfa. One, Fran Christina, you may remember from the Fabulous Thunderbirds,
right.
The drummer, and a guitar player from Austin who relocated to Marfa named Scrappy Judd Newcomb, who played with Ian McLaughlin's Bump Band and all sorts of...
That's where I know the name from.
Yeah, he's played with a lot of guys and is a great guitar player.
We had Ian on here a few years back before he passed, and that, I always thought, what a cool name, Scrappy.
Yeah.
You don't forget that.
I know. He could be one of those just one-name guys. Forget the next two names, you know.
Right.
Scrappy, Sting...
So the new album, it's new material that you've just written and recorded?
Well, it's not all just in the last year or two, but kind of over a period of time. But that's going to put that out next year. But so we got something new coming down the pike next year. But right now, excited about getting this stuff out that you've just been listening to today.
Now, the thing is, it says in here, Post Spirit Volume 1. So I'm assuming there's a Volume 2 and perhaps 3 coming?
Not a 3, but there is a Volume 2. And a lot of that, not all of it, but probably the most of it is going to consist of recordings I did in the early 80s with Andy Johns producing.
Okay.
And my brother playing on some, but also Pat Thrall, who you may remember.
From Pat Travers Band.
Pat Travers and Hughes Thrall Band, and great guitar player, and also Donnie Wynn on drums, who was Robert Palmer's drummer. And it sounds, when you hear it, it is very much a sound of the 80s, because it was done in the 80s, just as this new record, Post Spirit Volume 1, is. It sounds like the 70s, because that's when we did it.
It's interesting, as I'm listening to the record today, I'm thinking, the voice is familiar, but not. And I'm trying to figure who you sounded like or reminded me of. And somehow you fall between, in my ears, between Al Stewart and Van Morrison. You've got a unique voice, all your own, that recalls some of the great vocals of that era. Were you always a vocalist?
Well, you know, I was the Spirit Feedback. Right. Album that my brother and I did. I sang all the vocal. I wrote 7 of the songs, and John Locke wrote 2 of the instrumentals, but he wrote 1 song that had lyrics called Darkness, and I sang that too. So, and then Staley Brothers sang all those songs, and I've been a singing bass player for even in my college days, but. I appreciate I don't mind being compared to Van Morrison.
That's what it reminded me of. Again, you know, you sit there and you scratch your head saying, why does this sound familiar? It's one of those things that it kind of has a feel for something you've heard, but yet you know it, you didn't. And that's what I came upon. It was somewhere between those two guys. I do want to talk about the fact that you started out in law and then went to music, if I understand correctly. And if I don't, please correct me. How did you wind up in music?
It's not really like that. I mean,
okay.
I started playing in bands. I grew up in Austin, and I played in bands in high school, went to the University of Texas. I played in a band all through college. And in fact, the reason I went to law school is because I was in a band with 2 law students, the drummer and the guitar player. Actually, I was pre-med, and it was coming time for me to graduate. And they said, you can't go to med school. You'll break up the band because you'll have to leave Austin. They said, go to law school with us just for a year till we graduate, because we were making good money in this band. These guys already had a wife and a kid, and so, and I couldn't just sit out because Vietnam was going on. I wasn't excited about getting drafted, so right. I had to stay in school. And so I literally started law school thinking I'd go for a year to keep my band together. And after the first year, I realized I'd been duped, that if you finish the first year of law school, you might as well finish the whole thing, because that's the killer year. And so I continued playing in bands all through law school. And then when I got out, I thought, okay, if I don't give music a full-time try, I'm going to be one of those midlife crisis guys who, when I'm 45, starts a really bad band and embarrasses myself, friends, and family. So, so I'm going to go for it. And I went out to L.A. And got lucky right at first, because my drummer in the last band that I was in law school, Curly Smith, had gone out to L.A. about 6 or 8 months before I did, and he joined up with Mark Andes and Jay Ferguson, who were in the process of leaving Spirit mm-hmm. and starting JoJo Gunn. And so when I got out there, I met, through Curly, met Mark Andes and Jay, and they introduced me to the remaining members of Spirit, and I rehearsed with them for a while, and they asked me to join the group, so...
That was a very weird transitional type album feedback. For those of us that were Spirit fans, the sound was different. Obviously, the lineup was drastically different. I think that's the only one Randy California wasn't in. And as you mentioned, some of the other guys, Mark Andes and Curly and them, had been leaving. Jay Ferguson, I think, had left by then as well. So it was a unique sounding group. And as you mentioned, you wrote most of the material, so it reflected you as opposed to the psychedelic L.A. sound coming from Texas. So it was countrified, bluesy in some ways that other Spirit albums weren't.
Yeah, no, you're right. And actually, when I first joined the band, Randy was still in it. And I mean, we had some rehearsing, but... He was having, I guess, some issues at that time, and he decided to leave the group. And then John Locke and I went over to try to talk him out of it. And so, but John and Cass decided, well, if we continued working up new material, and actually we worked it up. Three-piece. All those songs on feedback were put together really as a trio, and then shortly before we recorded, my brother joined. And so really the bones of those songs were put together without a guitar player, and then we added guitar. So wow. It was kind of
that would have been a weird album without any guitar. I'm glad John came on board.
Well, I'm not saying we were going to record like that, but we weren't sure what we were going to do. But they knew that they wanted to keep working with the three of us. And then as it worked out, my brother was playing in Austin in a band with Tommy Shannon and Uncle John Turner, you know, mm-hmm. who, as you know, Tommy... Tommy and Uncle John Turner were the rhythm section for Johnny Winter
right.
when he made it big. And then, of course, Tommy became part of Double Trouble later on with Stevie. So my brother was in a band with those guys, and he was just 19 when he did this feedback album. So you listen to the guitar playing on that. It's pretty incredible. But he came out to visit and came over and jammed with us and was asked to join the group. And a few weeks later, we're in the studio, and that's what happened.
Wow. Yeah, when I was booking those guys, Fuzzy Knight was in the group. That was in the, I want to say, late 80s, maybe, mid-80s?
Something like that, yeah.
So I remember hanging out with Cass. He and I got to be pretty tight, and he was such a good guy.
He was. I'll tell you what. When when I joined the band, he was already like 50.
Yeah.
I was 24, I think, and he was and he was fun on the road. I mean, we would he'd always be the first guy. We'd get to a new town, he'd be the first guy outside, scope out the neighborhood, find all the good restaurants. He was a really energetic guy and a wonderful entertainer. I mean, as you know, I mean,
mm-hmm.
and he was bald and dressing in black way before anybody else back in those
right,
days.
Right. And, of course, for 12 Dreams, he painted his head. I remember that. But the interesting thing that bonded Cass and I was the fact that he was born here in Illinois and then later went out to L.A., of course, and the story is famous about the whole Randy California Hendrix thing. But I just thought he was just an amazing person. He was a jazz guy, played with Sun Ra and did all that and was such an older guy compared to the rest of the psychedelic summer bands, and yet he fit right in. He was like the grandfather of the scene.
Yeah, well, you know, he and John Locke gave the jazz flavor to
right
Spirit, and which made the band unique. I mean, even on the Feedback album that I did, I love those. The two, John Locke had two instrumentals that we did on that album that I still love to listen to today. And so that, and Ed's drum style was like the old jazzers, you know, that it was mostly on top of the drums, you know,
right.
Not a real heavy foot, like, like rock drummers more.
Yeah, his setup was unique too. I remember the two, it was like two giant toms almost that he, his primaries.
Yeah, he called those, I guess that was, he called those field drums, and I guess that's what they were. I don't know what that means.
I never understood it either. He's the only guy I've ever seen set up drums that way.
He was such a spectacle, and you know, we used to do, I don't know if you remember that song, because I bet they were doing it when you heard them too, called Elijah.
Yes.
It was an instrumental. It was basically just an excuse for everybody to take a solo at different times in the song. And so when it was time for his solo, he'd start playing, then he'd get off the drums, and then he'd come around, and he'd come play on my microphone stand, and I'd hold my bass up, and he'd play on my bass strings, and I always remember one night in Long Beach at Fox West Coast Theater, you know, one of those cool theaters that are always fun to play, and they had footlights, and when he came around on his solo, got off the drums, came over, he got down and started playing on the floor, and then he started knocking out one at a time those footlights, and the crowd went nuts because it was really, certainly, I'm sure the theater didn't appreciate it, but he would be drumming in every, you know, eighth beat or something. He'd knock out a footlight, just went down the road. So he was a unique guy, a great entertainer.
Wow. Well, let's get back to your music. The songs that are featured on Post Spirit, as I understand, they're songs that you had tried to record and release earlier, but none of these ever really made it to release prior to this. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. White Eyed and Innocent, let's see, I don't think, yeah, no. Well, actually, you know what? There's one song that has been coasting, there's a later version of that. I did an album in 82 or 83 that was released in Europe on Polydor. And there's a different version of Coastin'. So that song has been out in one form before, but it's not that track.
Okay.
But I think all the rest, even the songs haven't been out unless I'm forgetting about something. But Steve Cropp, I tell you, Feel the Heat is one that you can really hear Steve Cropper being Steve Cropper on it. It really does some cool things on there. And one interesting thing about when we were recording, with a mobile truck, a Haji mobile truck, in Studio City at this house I was living in. And Steve had this little Tweed amp that he was playing through, a Fender Harvard. And it looked in such good shape. I thought it was one of those reissues at the time they were doing. So I asked him, I said, oh, is that one of those Fender reissues? He said, no, man. He said, everything you've heard me do on record was through this amp. And we took a couple of days off. He leaned his guitar up against that amp and left. But during that time, everybody that came over to my house, I said, became like a shrine. I said, see this amp? Everything you've ever heard Steve Cropper do, he did through this amp. Wow. Now, about 6 months ago, I was on YouTube and just looking around, and I saw an interview with Steve Cropper popped up. So I clicked onto it, and he started talking about that amp. And it turns out that amp is now in the Smithsonian.
Wow. And it sat in your living room for a while.
Yeah, it sat in my living room for a while, and you can hear it on some of these songs.
Wow!
And it's now on the Smithsonian.
Well, let's play "Feel the Heat" if that's one that showcases that famous amp and Steve. Is there a story behind this song other than what you just shared?
Yeah, there is kind of. It was. I was in New York one summer, and it was the 4th of July, and my girlfriend had to work that day. And so I was on my own, and so I just said, you know, let me just get a pencil and pad or kind of go around town and see what's happening in New York on the 4th of July and get some ideas. Maybe I can make a song out of it. And so it was kind of a conscious effort to try to capture something about that day in New York.
All right, well, this is it. We'll be back in just a moment, and we'll talk to Al some more and play some more music. You're listening to Midwest Beat on Lakeshore Public Radio, National Public Radio.
July, New York City, and I'm really feeling the heat. Cops on horseback in Central Park and on Broadway, they're pounding their beats. Black men playing jungle drums out on Amsterdam Street. But I'm light-skinned, fair-headed, from out of town, and I can really feel the heat. So lay me on your big old bed, make me feel the things you say. Turn on your window fade, oh baby, tell me I'm your favorite man. It's 4th of July, New York City, and there are fireworks all around. But you never know what's going on in Chinatown. The Upper East Side is all deserted, 'cause they have houses at the beach. But they're hanging out in Harlem, and man, you can really feel the heat. Get me on your big old bed. You just got to make me feel the thing. It's a man alive. Need your loving to survive.
last 20 years on land. Now he plays with children in a five-plug fountain and feels complete. Sailing empty bottles down the gutter, he is now captain of his fleet. But when you're living down in the village with artists, dykes, and queens, well, Independence Day is every day like any day you see. So baby, on your bed, ooh, you just got to make me feel the things you say. Cut on your bed, come out of your favorite. Make a love on cool white sheets, and I can really, really feel the heat. Oh, I can really feel the heat.
Feeling the heat? I wish we could. It's cold here in Chicagoland already, heading into winter. That's new old music from the Post Spirit Volume 1, 74 to 78 compilation by Mr. Al Staley, who was a former member of Spirit, but also has been writing music for so many people over the years and is an entertainment attorney, and he's joining us now as our special guest. Al, that song was brilliant. Again, I'm sitting here going, it sounds so fresh for being so old. when you put it together, when you revisited these songs, and what was your thought? Were you thinking, will it sound contemporary? Will it sound dated? Is it just a historical piece, or are you hoping that that the radios pick up on it? And are they?
Well, I mean, it would be obviously wonderful if radio picked up on it, but we're not even promoting it to radio. I'm not hiring indie promoters or anything. But obviously, it would be wonderful if they did, but, it's nice to hear you say that it does have a fresh sound, because, you know, I'm probably the worst one to judge, because I've lived with these things for a long time. So
Right. Even
though I'm proud of them, it's really not for me to say whether they sound fresh or not, but I appreciate you saying so.
Who was on the keyboards on that? That was pretty sprightly and lively. I enjoyed that.
I think, you know, it was one of two. I'm trying to Pete Sears, you know, from the Jefferson Starship.
Starship.
He's playing bass on that, but as you know, he's a keyboard player too. And I can't remember whether he also played keyboards on that, or it could have been a guy named Andy Kahn who played them certain things. I think it may have been Andy.
Okay.
I will have to admit, there are a couple of tracks on this record where I just really couldn't remember who played on every single think, because, like I say, some of them, that one was recorded in 78. Okay. But like I say, like the title says, some of them go back to 74. So, and some of them were meant to be, they weren't being recorded for an album. And what blows my mind is how you know, I thought they were demos, and it turns out that really they sound, some of the players on there were so good. See, Curly played drums on a few things. We had Gary Malibur, like I said, you know, as you may know, that played on Van Morrison's Moondance album, mm-hmm. and played on a lot of the Steve Miller hits. In fact, I remember him, I think it was on Wide Eyed and Innocent, he pulled out the cymbal and said, I'm going to use this is my Moondance cymbal. He said, this is the one I used on Moondance. Of course, who knows? Maybe he said that to all the guys he played with.
That's true. You know, we're name-dropping a lot of folks that you have recorded with on these songs and on others. And one of the things that we should also touch on is the fact that as a songwriter, there have been many famous names that have brought your songs into their albums and into their projects. I know Keith Moon is one of them. Back in 75, 76, he had recorded something from you.
Yeah, Crazy Like a Fox. If you like, I'll tell you how that came about.
Sure.
Just like I said, my brother was playing with JoJo Gunn at the time, and I was down at the studio, one of their sessions, and the recording engineer, John Stronach, happened to mention, he said, I'm getting ready to start a Keith Moon album next weekend. I said, really? Who's producing? And he said, Mal Evans. I said, Mal Evans, the Beatles roadie that used to be, you'd see in all the Beatle movies, the guy with horn-rimmed glasses running around helping the Beatles. He said, yeah. And I said, well, you know, I might have a song or two for him. He said, well, come on down to the record plant on Wednesday. I'll introduce you to Mal and see what happens. And so I took two songs and played him the first one. And he said, I don't know. And then I played him Crazy Like a Fox. And he said, yeah, I could hear Keith doing that. We'll cut it on Friday. I thought, wow. You pitch it on Wednesday, they cut it on Friday. This is the way song plugging should always be.
Right.
And I said, well, do you have the musicians for the session? He said, well, no. I said, you know, of course, I know the song. But I said, also, my brother, who plays with JoJo Gunn, he knows the song. And so Mal said, well, why don't we get all of JoJo Gunn to play on it? So I called the guys up. Want to do a Keith Moon session on Friday? Sure. So we go down there at the record plant. And in addition to me and JoJo Gunn, he had also called Jesse Ed Davis and Spencer Davis.
Oh, okay.
So the way we cut the basic track on that was really kind of unusual. Keith on one set of drums, Curly Smith on another set of drums, my brother and Jesse Ed Davis on electric guitars, Jay Ferguson on keyboards, Jimmy Randall on bass. Mark Andes had left JoJo Gunn by then, and Jimmy was their bass player. And me on acoustic six string, and Spencer Davis sitting next to me on acoustic 12 string, and that's the way we cut the track. That's the way they wanted to do it. And so then I get out there. I'd written a lyric out for Keith and put on a music stand. I got out there with headphones with him to kind of cue him where to come in, because he'd probably only heard the song the day before. And so he's got a bottle of Cavassier in his left hand and is reeling around. I'm cueing him. He's saying, stand back. You got to give the girl room to move. She's quite easy like a fox. And that fox got her eyes on you. You know, he wasn't really singing, but he was being Keith Moon
right.
All over the record, which is exactly what you wanted anyway.
Yeah.
And so they ended up calling me back for some other sessions. I ended up playing on about half the record. And when they put the record out, Crazy Like a Fox was the first single that they put out.
First song on the album, too.
Yeah, first song. And so that was kind of that was satisfying because I know John Lennon gave him one song that had never been recorded before, and there's some other writers much better known than myself. So, and it was just a great experience getting to know Keith and going up to his house, having dinner with he and his girlfriend, me and my girlfriend at the time. And so, that's the Keith Moon story.
Are you still pitching songs, or are you keeping them for yourself for the new project? Are you still writing a lot? Where are you at right now as a songwriter?
Well, you never write, or at least I never write as often as I think I should. But yes, I still am. And there's some on this project that I did in Marfa. You're going to hear some new ones there. And that album is going to have a different flavor than either Volume 1 or Volume 2, because it's really... it'll have more of a Texas flair, and it's not overly produced. You know, it's going to be like, actually, the bass player, I didn't play bass on it. Chris Marsh, you may know him from, he played for years with Eric Johnson, and he and Scrappy have worked a lot together. And so I wanted to, because I'd written the songs on acoustic guitar, I wanted to play the rhythm and, so Chris played bass, and so it's basically four guys, and not a lot of of course there's some overdubs, but it's not a heavily produced album, and I think it works.
When do you anticipate that being released?
Well, we're talking about maybe as early as spring, but. It's done. I have to get it mastered, and we have to get the artwork together. And so we're kind of shooting for around March, April, but I can't say we're going to make it yet. I think we can. But, you know, the thing about, I'm sure if we're going to do vinyl, which I'd like to do, that would come later because, as you've probably
The pressing plans from everybody are backed up. Way back
then. Yeah. In fact, I was going to do vinyl on this Post-Spirit album, but we weren't going to be able to get it for so long that we decided just to go ahead and release it digitally. And it could be that, who knows, maybe when we do Volume 2, it might be nice to do Volume 1 and Volume 2 together in a
two-double album
record set, you know?
Yeah. Now, is this available on CD as well or just digital? Because I bought the digital.
I've got right now, there's the only place you can buy it is on my website at alstahaley.com. So I've got some, but it's not going through a distributor at the moment. So if anybody wants the CD, they can go to alstahaley.com and go to the merch.
I just signed on there, and I got to say, I love the album art. That's pretty cool. Who did that?
Well, there's quite a story behind that. In the summer of '69, I spent in New York City. It was between my second and third year of law school. And I was working for, had a summer job for ASCAP. And I was up at ASCAP one day, and a guy walks through and says, "Hey, anybody want two tickets to the David Frost show?" And so I ended up going to the David Frost show and get called out of the audience when he was interviewing John Hartford. I ended up going up stage playing one of my songs on the David Frost show. But then after that, I got the chance to audition for Hair. Hair was running on Broadway at that time. But, you know, they were well, continually looking for cast members because, you know, people come and go.
Right.
And so I did an audition for Hair, and then James Rado and Jerry Ragney, you know, the two
the
main
creators.
Guys that wrote,
yeah,
created, took me to lunch and said, look, if you'll stick around New York for a couple of months, there's a guy leaving the play, that, and you'll be perfect for that part if you can stick around. And while we were having lunch, Rado was doing most of the talking, and Ragney sitting there kind of drawing in a pad. And at the end of lunch, he pulls this kind of psychedelic portrait of me out of his pad and gives it to me. And I stuck it in a frame. I just had it in a frame all these years and didn't really frame it very well. You see kind of the smudge
crease
marks
in the middle and stuff, yeah.
And all this stuff. But I was thinking of what to do for album art, and I thought, you know what? This is really kind of cool. It's a little bit pre-74, but it's I like the idea of using it as the album cover. And so anyway,
it's definitely a great story to go along with the great songs. I mean, and this is such a historical time capsule for you as a creative entity. I just love this.
Yeah, it really that's a very nice way to put it, a time capsule. It is that, and for people who are, if it sounds fresh, as you say, all
I
the better.
So.
But for people who nostalgic for 70s music, but 70s music that they haven't heard before, you know, this could be for them.
Right. Now, you mentioned the new album possibly coming out as early as spring. When is Volume 2 planned?
I think trying to figure out with it, because it's also occurred, actually, Ron Stone from Gold Mountain Management, who was our manager in Spirit, when I was in Spirit, and later, you may know of Gold Mountain, they managed Nirvana, he managed Bonnie Raitt for years, and all sorts of people. He's managing this project, and it occurred to us as we started all this that 2022 is the 50th anniversary of the Feedback album.
Wow.
And
you're right.
2023 is the 50th anniversary of the Staheli Brother album. So there's some talk about, well, wait a minute, maybe it would make sense to, I'm thinking maybe it would make sense to, talking about double packages, is do a vinyl of Spirit Feedback album and the Staheli Brother album in a double vinyl package for the 50th of both, and maybe do something like that for Record Store Day or something.
Right.
I don't know. What do you think?
I think it'd be a good idea, especially to show the twin sides of the brothers. Epic had the rights to Feedback. Who released the Staheli Brothers?
Well, Epic released it too.
Okay. Well, you being an attorney, I'm sure you can secure the rights to those and get that done.
Well, at the very least, I know that they will license it to us. And so at any rate, this goes back to your question about when is everything going to be released. And so there's quite a few projects that we're talking about releasing over the next couple of years. In the exact order, I don't know. I know for sure we want the next thing before Volume 2. We want to release something that really is fresh and new and recently recorded, and that would be the Marfa Sessions. And so then maybe Volume 2 after that, or is it going to probably Volume 2 after that, but then maybe if this 50th anniversary idea works out. And so it could be like a couple of years of one release after the other, you know.
You get your work cut out for you, sir.
That's right.
One thing, I'm going to ask you to put on both hats at the same time. As a musician and as a longtime entertainment attorney, NPR is always about educating as well as entertainment. So we got just a couple minutes left. What is the one tip you would give a young artist to protect themselves? We've heard all the horror stories over the years of losing publishing and everything else that went on. I don't know what it's like today in the digital world, but I know that there was a lot of musicians that really got taken to the cleaners. What is a show business is two words, show and business. You are in both. What is the best piece of advice you could offer a talent today?
Well, registering copyrights with the U.S. Copyright Office is a great start, because and some people think, well, why should I register it with copyright? And some people don't even, they'll tell me, oh, I forgot to register with BMI. And I said, well, that's not copyright registration. That's just letting your Performance Rights Society know it's out there so they can collect performance royalties for you. But even though when you fix your song in a medium, even if you just sing it into your iPhone, yes, you're protected to some extent. However, the reason you should register and register hopefully within the first 3 months of first publication is if someone willfully infringes your copyright, you can then elect statutory damages, and their downside becomes a potential $150,000 per infringement, as opposed to actual damages. And it could be that you might win, but then when it comes to the damage phase, you can't show that you're only damaged, you know, $500 or $1,000, then it's not worth filing the lawsuit. But if you can, if the other side, if the infringer's downside is a potential $150,000 per infringement, they usually are interested in settling.
Right.
So okay. Copyright registration is not that expensive. Make sure you do it right. You can do it yourself, but sometimes better to have a professional do it.
Right.
Yeah.
One last question, and that is, you know, in the old days, it used to be common belief. You write a song, you record it, you put it on cassette, you mail it to yourself, the postage stamp, since it's a government entity, will time stamp it, that you own it. That doesn't stand in court anymore, does it?
Well, I mean, it's evidence of when you wrote it, yes. As I just said, that wouldn't, even if you won, then, you know, there's two, in a lawsuit, there's two parts of the trial. There's guilt or innocence, and then there's the damages, you know.
Right.
And so you might say, okay, yeah, they infringed your copyright now. How much did it hurt you? And you know, well, not that much. So that's why it's better to register.
All right. We've been talking with Al Staehely, and you can reach him at alstaehely.com. You can buy the new album there on CD. You can download it. There's all kinds of good stuff coming down the tunnel, so to speak. So, Al, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. I have nice memories of Chicago when we played the Aragon Ballroom and Harry Crown Theater back in the day.
That was a while ago.
It was. Well, thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you, Al. All right, we're going to leave you with Like a River, closing track here.
Okay.
Bye-bye. In love like a waterfall, everybody gets so high when the children fly. Take a message.